A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. The known universe is ruled by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, my father. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel. The Spacing Guild and its navigators, who the spice has mutated over 4,000 years, use the orange spice gas, which gives them the ability to fold space. That is, travel to any part of the universe without moving. Oh yes, I forgot to tell you. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. A desolate, dry planet with vast deserts. Hidden away within the rocks of these deserts are a people known as the Fremen, who have long held a prophecy that a man would come, a Messiah, who would lead them to true freedom. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is Frank Herbert's Dune and the Dune Saga. Here to discuss it with me is my co-host from the sister show of this podcast, the AU Wishbone Podcast's own, John Ringer. Welcome back aboard, John.
Thanks for having me, Van. Very excited to be here.
Well, it's always fun to me when we can come on, when you can come on the White Rocket Show and we can talk about some non-sports thing just for the change up, you know, a little bit. Because we, for those that don't know, John and I do a purely football-related show, the AU Wishbone. Basically every week during the season and every 2 weeks in the off season. And so, during the fall, it sort of takes precedence over this show just in terms of taking up so much time. So it's neat to get to talk to John about something besides that for a change every now and then. We did a best, favorite movies episode, and we've done a couple of others.
We did a Game of Thrones, Song of Fire and Ice podcast.
Yes, we did. And this one I think is going to be interesting because John and I have both known that each other was a fan of the Dune books for a long time, but we've never had that much opportunity to really talk about it. So it should be fun just to kind of dig into this topic a little bit and explore it in some depth. What I think sort of we've been planning to do it for some time, But several months ago, I went back and rewatched the Sci-Fi Channel's miniseries Dune and then Children of Dune. And then John has been able to watch them. Had you seen them before, or was that the first time?
I had never seen them before.
Okay, and I'm really interested to hear what you thought about them when we get to that point in our agenda. But first up, for those listeners that aren't as familiar with Dune, how would you describe the overall Dune world or universe?
Well, I guess the first thing is we're going to focus on the original Frank Herbert series, mm-hmm. not on books that have been written, you know, since his right. death by his son or anybody else. And I guess I would describe it as it's pure science fiction, you know, far in the future, 20,000 years in the future. Mm-hmm. Mankind is scattered throughout the universe, and there's kind of a feudal society with an emperor and then kind of dukes or barons who control, you know, a planet or multiple planets. And they the most important planet in the universe is called Dune, and it's because of a substance there, which is a referred to as melange or spice, and it is a substance which grants you, you know, long life and also extraordinary mental abilities. It gives people the ability to travel between solar systems, to give people the ability to see into the future and expand their minds and stuff. So it is, you know, literally priceless. And so, but Dune is also an incredibly inhospitable, dangerous place. And so the story centers around a family that takes over Dune, the Duke and his family take over Dune and their battle with their enemies and for control of the spice. And it's really brilliant science fiction, I think, mm-hmm. the original book, especially because of the way that Frank Herbert really thought about the future and the human development and how society could be and how humans could be and really did a lot of things different than most science fiction books, which I think mm-hmm. are really interesting. And I loved it from the first time I read it.
Yeah, yeah, me too. You know, it took me about three attempts when I was young to kind of get through it because it's not young adult, you know what I mean? It's got a lot of stuff going on. It's got intellectual stuff. It's got philosophy. It's got religion. I mean, it's got all kinds of layers of stuff. And, you know, when you said that, one thing I wanted to mention, one of the things that makes it different from almost everything that came before and a lot of what's come since is when you're talking about the spice, I think it's interesting how a big focus of the Dune universe is on humans and the biological functions of humans being the most advanced thing rather than machines. You know, in other words, he has a thing that happened in the past before the books called the Butlerian Jihad, where machines, thinking machines, robots and computers mm-hmm. and everything, kind of like the Terminator / modern Battlestar Galactica, you know, they were all destroyed and you know, you're not allowed to make a machine that can be like a computer anymore. And what that means is that the spice is what allows human potential to open up so that humans can do all the various things that a machine, a computer would have done. And I think that's really interesting because it lets you combine the far future and super high technology in some ways, like traveling across the universe, like hyperspace, basically. You combine that with a very feudal, almost medieval people fighting with knives. You know, there's an interesting juxtaposition of the very future and the very old in these books.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, it's a very feudal society and mm-hmm. in some ways – it's great science fiction because he kind of rejected the idea of there's going to be super easy technology that does everything for you. Mm-hmm. And that really is one of the main themes is this idea that he, you know, they have this basically religious prohibition against artificial intelligence. You can make no machine in the mold of a human mind, basically. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these different paths they've gone down to unlock human potential, to allow humans to do the things that you would do through technology. Mm-hmm. And it really, really makes it interesting. And I think it's, you know, so often in science fiction, technology is kind of the crutch that people go, oh, well, you know, there's a way to do this. But he really thought about human development. And so it's about the use of the spice, but also about, you know, people that are looking at breeding humans for certain traits and attributes, and over thousands of generations trying to get, you know, unlock human potential through that kind of development, and also people that over thousands of years have developed, you know, mental and physical control over their abilities. There's one group that has, you know, basically can control every muscle and nerve in their body, and are immune to disease and that kind of stuff. And so that kind of thing is really fascinating.
And the Spacing Guild that are basically mutating away from being humans as they become more and more able to travel through the universe and navigate, the guild navigators to fold space, which is sort of their version of, you know, hyperspace or faster than light travel. So yeah, each of the factions has sort of its own way that it's taking human evolution to make them better at the thing they do, you know, whether it be navigation or the breeding program and I guess that kind of takes us in part to the main character of the first novel, at least, Paul Atreides, because he is sort of the end result of thousands of years of this sort of intentional breeding of humans, even though he doesn't know it really, you know.
There's a group. Yeah, you know, Paul is the son of the Duke that I referenced earlier, whose family takes over Dune, Paul Atreides, and his mother is part of a group called the Bene Gesserit, who are basically a society or organization of women who have dedicated themselves to basically focusing on human development and human potential and unlocking it. And they have a lot of abilities and a lot of plans and organization, and they're very, very extremely capable. And so his mother is one of those people. And the book opens with kind of one of the leaders of that order coming to test Paul. Cause one of their beliefs is that, you know, there are lots of, you know, Homo sapiens out there basically, but there are only so many humans. And the difference between humans and non-humans is the ability to control our emotions and to not let them get the better of us. And so there's a famous scene at the very opening of the book where basically Paul has to stick his hand in a box that causes extreme pain, and he thinks his hand is being destroyed by kind of fire or whatever. And as she tells him, she basically puts a poison needle to his throat and tells him, if you pull your hand out, I'm going to kill you. And so he has to control himself and resist. And the idea is that people, you know, people who aren't human wouldn't be able to do that, wouldn't be able to say, basically, I'm going to lose my hand and I'm going to keep it here in this ridiculous pain. And then she would kill him. But so he gets through that. And then through his own development and training and through the use of the spice, he unlocks his potential and becomes this Kwisatz Haderach, which is basically a
space messiah.
A space messiah, basically, is the easy way to say this.
I've always thought he's sort of Muhammad, Jesus, and Lawrence of Arabia all at the same time. I'll kind of expand on that in a minute, but yeah, he's the protagonist. He's sort of the Luke Skywalker. In fact, I would argue that Star Wars, I've always said that Star Wars is Dune without the intellectual and philosophical stuff woven in as much. There's some, but there's a lot that they have in common. You have a desert planet, you have a young man growing up on it who has some kind of special powers, and you have a galactic empire type thing that's militarily powerful, but not as spiritually powerful as the, you know, quote unquote, the good guys. And so I think there's a lot of bleed over between those two.
I never really thought about that before, but you're exactly right.
Yeah, I think George Lucas had read Dune, and he that wasn't exactly what he was doing, but I think there's a lot of influence there. I think it was in the back of his mind, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, Paul Atreides, the main character, the young man, he's sort of Lawrence of Arabia in that he's the outsider from a different civilization who comes to the desert and ends up being as good or better at desert stuff than the people who live there.
Right.
And becomes their leader against the big military force. You know, in Lawrence of Arabia, he's British and he leads the Arabs against the Ottoman Empire.
Exactly.
And here he's, he's just from another planet, a water planet, which is about as alien as you can get on Arrakis, Dune. And he leads the Fremen, who are basically Arabs, against the Roman Empire, or the Persian Empire, I guess, is even more accurate. I mean, I guess it really is sort of the Persian Empire. Shaddam IV is the emperor, and he's Padishah. I mean, it basically is the Persian Roman Empire of the far future. There's a lot of historical allegory that I think carries over, you know.
Right.
yeah.
And their religion is basically Zen Buddha, is a combination of Zen and Buddhism,
and Islam. I mean, to a certain degree,
that's right, absolutely,
and that's why he's sort of Muhammad in the sense that he's the prophet, but he also sort of becomes the Messiah, becomes Jesus in a way, because he's both the prophet bringing the word to the people, but then also becomes almost a god himself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then his son, of course, as we'll, you know, touch on later, becomes god emperor, basically, so, and lives for a bajillion years. So, yeah.
And one of the things with Paul that develops is, because he takes the spice and then he unlocks all these things, is he has prescience. He can see pathways mm-hmm. in the future and kind of guide himself and his people and ultimately human civilization down these different pathways. And that's a ability that, you know, people have been terrified of because of its potential. And then, so there's a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of time in the whole series of books is spent on the idea of kind of prescience, the ability to see the future. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? And are you creating the future, or are you seeing alternatives and choosing them, or are you locked into certain ones?
Right.
A lot of time talking about that.
And see, Paul is sort of an imperfect vessel too, because he was a generation early. He was supposed mm-hmm. to be a girl that would get with the youngest member of the bad guy family. We can touch on them in a minute, the Harkonnens, mm-hmm. and produce the sort of Messiah, the Kwisatz Haderach. But but what happens is that Paul's mother, the Duke's wife, concubine, that's an important point later. She has a boy. I guess she's able to choose in this. You know, they have physical control of their bodies. And so he sort of gets what his child was supposed to get, but imperfectly. And so he spends a lot of the story kind of seeing the future, but not, I guess, as clearly. At least that was my interpretation. Correct me if I'm wrong. He sees it, but not as perfectly as he should. And he's never quite sure of exactly what to do. It really kind of falls to his son Leto too, to be the one that actually starts changing the human race the way that maybe he would have if he had come a generation later. Does that sound kind of right?
That's fair.
Yeah. So that's a lot of the conflict in the first book, and the second book in particular, is that he's got this power, but he can't necessarily control it completely. And he's kind of a victim of it as much as he is a master of it, wouldn't you say?
That's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, he does feel kind of his life's a little bit been taken away, and he's thrown into this position where he's, you know, on the run, and then becomes the leader of the Fremen, and then basically they take over the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's ultimately responsible for everything. So,
yeah, it's the Arab Caliphate. I mean, it's the idea that you have these big empires, the Persians, the Romans, and there are the Arabs in the desert, but everybody thinks there's like six of them. You know,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden they just exploded out of the desert and conquered Persia and almost conquered Rome, you know, in like 100 years. And that's basically what's going on here, except that it's Lawrence of Arabia leading them instead of Muhammad. And well, he is Muhammad, you know, and those guys. So, yeah, I mean, I just love that clearly Herbert really knew his history, and he incorporated a lot of existing history into kind of this far future story. To make it have a more of a feeling of being kind of real and grounded, I think, in a way. So, well, you know, we've talked a little bit about the sort of man versus artificial intelligence going on in human development.
There's one more thing about that mm-hmm. I think is really fascinating. Because there are not computers
mm-hmm.
of any kind, basically, other than kind of some simple library kind of systems, they develop a human version of a computer called a Mentat,
mm-hmm.
which is basically through training of your mind and through use of spice, basically humans could do things that you would normally rely on a computer on, for example, having huge databases of information and be able to do projections of, based on, you know, basically huge amounts of data. So all the major families, for example, would have these mentats working for them, following the leader around, and they could say, hey, what, you know, what about this? What about that? And the mentat could be taking in information all the time from different sources and then analyzing and giving out projections. And but it's purely, there's no technology to it at all. It's purely the human mind developed and trained to be able to do this. And I think that's really a, you know, interesting way to think about where humans could be in the future. And and it's just a cool ability that he puts in there as a way to, you know, allow them to do things without technology.
And I think Paul ends up having that power too, right? I mean,
he does.
He does basically everything.
Yes.
He's a fighter. He's a mentat. He's the Kwisatz Haderach. He's the space messiah. He's the duke of the Atreides. And he's the leader of the Fremen Arab warriors, the Fedaken later. So who launches a jihad. And I mean, I like that Herbert uses a lot of actual, you know, historical terminology and religious terminology, which gives it sort of that verisimilitude. Like, you know, Paul doesn't just go against the empire. It's a jihad.
That's right.
You know, it's a holy war.
That's right. It's a holy war that sweeps across the galaxy. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like a rebellion or we're conquering these, you know, we're fighting to take our some land back. What it really is, a jihad that sweeps across in a wave or whatever, and converts people.
And sort of, yeah, it does convert them, right, to his religion, as you see in Dune Messiah and Children of Dune. And it sort of carries him along like he's been swept up in the wave. I mean, that's one of the things that we kind of see in the second book in particular, is how a movement can become so powerful that it takes on a life of its own and leaves its own leader, the person who started it, almost either behind or leaves them very few options. Because, you know, what it made me think of is, like, you know, at the beginning of World War One, everybody saw there was this giant war coming and all the leaders of the countries were telegraphing each other saying, let's don't do this. Let's back down. They're like, yeah, let's back down. I agree. No, we all agree. Let's back down. And they didn't back down because they discovered as the ball got rolling, they discovered that none of them were powerful enough to actually stop the ball from rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing here. Paul gets this jihad started. And then, you know, later on, he kind of like, maybe this wasn't the greatest thing ever, and it's like too late. it's out of your hands now. It's a wave hitting the shore, and you can't really stop the ocean. So this is all kind of neat, you know, sort of historical and cultural ideas. I mean, it's amazing too, because it came along just a few. It's from 1965 is when Dune was mm-hmm. first written, which was not that much longer after Isaac Asimov's Foundation series. And I like Asimov's Foundation trilogy, but this is just so much more sophisticated, just almost infinitely more sophisticated in every way, you know, not just in sort of historical. I mean, because they're both sort of historical analogies to, you know, the Roman Empire or whatever. But this, I mean, this goes into so many things that never even tried to touch on, you know.
That's right. There's a lot there.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And like you said, this is not easy, you know, middle school level stuff. There's a lot of stuff there, a lot of science and philosophy and, you know, a lot of complicated stuff. But it is so good, so well thought out.
I think that's what highlights the difference between it and the later non-Frank Herbert books that we're not going to get into is that you don't maybe realize just how sophisticated these six original Dune books are. I mean, maybe you do, but maybe not quite realize just how sophisticated they are until you read stuff that's written by very good and able writers later, and you see just the drop-off. Not necessarily in quality of the writing, but in the depth.
Yes, that's right. It's the depth, and it's the what we talked about. This is somebody who really sat down and thought deeply about where human beings were going to go and human society, and it kind of put that together. And, you know, the later books are more of just a story.
Right, exactly. They tell a good story, and they're you know, what do we say? They're a workmanlike efforts. They're not bad. They're not bad at all. Nope. And if they didn't have the word Dune on them, they'd be very decent modern science fiction novels. But compared to what came before, I mean, there would be whole chapters of Frank Herbert's six books that I would read, especially the later ones. There'd be whole chapters that I would be reading and going, I have no idea what he's talking about here, but I know it must be awesome, so I'm going to keep going.
That's right.
And you never get that from the, you know, from the later books. It's all very much on the surface. What you see is what you get. So,
right.
But I mean, yeah, the sophisticated layer. I mean, you just have confidence that it'll make sense. It's not making a lot of sense right now. Even the simplest action scenes in those first six books have so many layers of onion around them that you're never entirely sure, you know, that you know exactly what's. Well, again, maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just not sophisticated enough to completely understand it. But I always kept feeling like I may be missing out on whole layers of subtext here that I'm not seeing. And I probably was. So,
well, that's what I'm saying. Because the other part is, I mean, there's whole military training and strategy parts of it. And then there's this whole, the other part we haven't got to yet is kind of the ecology and planetary environmentalism side of the books, which is a whole other thing. And there's a whole lot of science. I mean, that's what really inspired him at the beginning.
Yeah.
Was this work he did in Oregon or whatever on the, where they were trying to protect the dunes on the coast or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there's a whole science on that side too, which there's a lot going on.
You know, I think a lot of people have over the years have sort of focused on that part of it, that it's about water conservation because they're on a desert planet and they had to learn, you know, the Fremen are very skilled at using very little water and recycling their body's water and that kind of thing. And water is very valuable. It's interesting because Herbert had said in interviews that it's sort of you have both water as the scarce and valuable resource, and you have the spice. So it's kind of like on Dune, water is the thing that's really valuable. Spice is everywhere. Mm-hmm. But everywhere else in the universe, there's plenty of water, and it's the spice that's valuable. So there's an interesting kind of conflict back and forth between, you know, what's valuable to some people is almost worthless to others and vice versa. You know, like all the Fremen just basically bathe in the spice. It's all the way around them and everything that they do. But they're desperate for water, which is just meaningless to everybody else almost. So it's really fascinating how there's that whole ecology aspect to it. And you have one character that kind of bridges that, the Liet Kynes, the planet, the ecologist, who has one foot in the imperial world and is there to kind of do stuff for the emperor. But on the other hand, he's a Fremen himself and is kind of seen as like, I mean, I guess he's almost like John the Baptist in a way. You know, he is clearing the way for the Messiah. So so this is fascinating, the way that you get this juxtaposition of all these different, completely different, you know, areas of thinking. Ecology and philosophy and religion and military and future speculation and all that. I mean, it really is remarkable.
Well, and then like genetics and breeding and development and there's a lot of good stuff.
It's interesting too, because, you know, you mentioned the Bene Gesserit, and you can never really tell if at the beginning they're more like the bad guys or among, there's many bad guys more. And by bad guys, I guess we really just mean they have their own interests at stake and they're often in conflict with the protagonist. So therefore they're the bad guys in the story. But as the larger story unfolds, they really become sort of the main good guys, don't they? They become sort of the main protagonists.
That's right. And they're fascinating because, you know, they have this, we haven't even talked about this other ability they have, which is this ability to, they're called Reverend Mothers, where they link back and they basically have the memories of everyone in their genetic history, all the women. And so they basically know everything those people knew, and they can basically talk to their ancestors and get ideas and, perceptions of situations of people and advice from them, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're dealing with one of these Reverend Mothers, you're dealing with someone who knows what they know and has all the superior training and intelligence stuff, but also has the advice and wisdom of 1,000 generations going back. And so they're you know, that's a whole other side of this thing, which is really interesting.
And again, that's a biological human thing as opposed to having like having them in computers or something.
That's right.
Like you'd see in some other stories, perhaps, you know, where they'd be stored away in a vault or something. So, yeah, that is fact. And some characters can't handle that. I mean, I think that Aaliyah, whichever it is, her story, Paul's little sister, which really comes to the forefront in I guess the second and third books, mm-hmm. is really fascinating too, because she develops that power, but she can't really control it, and so that the ghosts of the past are able to increasingly control her. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a tragic story of how she loses control of her, not just her mind, but all these other minds that are inside her head. So mm-hmm. there's all this danger to it too. So what other themes and ideas run through it that we haven't mentioned that play out? So much.
I mean, it's interesting because you and I are both like political science people, the idea that there's a feudal society,
mm-hmm.
Which makes a lot of sense because of how long it takes to travel from place to place. So you have to have people who have some kind of, you know, somebody in the area has to have basically their own authority to get things done. So that would be like a duke or a baron or whatever. And then also there's this emperor who's the center of everything. But somebody's got to be in charge, but there's not going to be other forms of, you know, it's not going to be a representative democracy anything else in the future. It's going to be some kind of system based on, okay, here's the limits of what we could do technology wise. So this is how we're going to organize our society.
And the emperor is not like an all powerful emperor at all. He's almost more like the Holy Roman Emperor that was chosen from among a bunch to get the job done. And it's made very clear to him by the other power brokers in this universe that if you can't get the job done, if you can't keep the spice flowing, we'll just replace you with somebody else. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like the commercial interests are even higher than the political, you know. This is an economic empire, and the foundation is the spice. And that was another analogy that Herbert had admitted, was that it's also oil. You know, it's the international oil trade and people fighting to control the Middle East, you know, which takes us back to the desert again. So there's just all this fascinating layers of stuff. Well, we talked about the Atreides. They're sort of the good guys in this story, at least in terms of they're who we focus on, and they're, you know, that's Paul's family, so we're kind of rooting for them just the way the story is laid out. Then there's the Imperial family, the Carinos, they're not really the bad guys so much as just, you know, because the Emperor is not like the Star Wars Emperor that's just evil incarnate. He's just kind of a bureaucrat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think the Carino Emperor said on the floor, he's just a bureaucrat trying to do his job. And he's not the nicest guy, but he's not the worst guy either. But you have some really black hat villains. Tell us about them.
Well, the villain side of the story is House Harkonnen. They're the rivals to the Atreides, and they, you know, had Dune before and they want it back. And basically they gave up Dune to the Atreides as kind of part of a big setup,
mm-hmm.
where basically they're going to work with the Emperor to, you know, wipe them out and once and for all. And they have a vendetta going back and forth between the families for, you know, hundreds of generations. They hate each other, and they have all these formal rules for the vendetta and stuff. But basically the Harkonnens are willing to break any rules and do any treachery they can in order to win. And So they're the real bad guys of the story.
Right.
And so the main character is, you know, the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, who's this giant obese guy who floats around basically with anti-gravity suspensors and, mm-hmm. You know, tortures people and kills people. And very sadistic. Exactly. And rules his planet with an iron fist. No mercy on his people. And his heir is named Fade Rotha.
That was the character. If you've seen the 1984 David Lynch movie, this was Sting.
Yes, actually, in a minute we'll cover the TV series in that movie. We'll
yeah, we got to mention that movie too for a minute. It's worth mentioning just for a second.
But you know, the Fade Royth is kind of the heir. He's the superbly trained. He's kind of Paul's counterpoint, and he's kind of the darker version of him.
Well, he was supposed to marry Paul if Paul was a girl.
So right, and then they would
the same age.
That's right. And then and there's another nephew who's a rabbin who's kind of the thug beast guy that once they kick the Atreides out, they put him in charge, and he kind of rules as the evil bad guy on Dune. And so Harkonnen's basically come up with all these plots to get the Atreides over the different books and all these and basically never stop messing with them in different ways. And, you know, but it's interesting characters, well-developed. They have a real sense of who they are and what they're doing and why they're doing it. And, the, you know, blame, you know, the Atreides for different things that have happened in their family over the years. And you know, they're very effective at what they do. So.
Yeah. They, I mean, he couldn't have, he really just makes the Harkonnens as repulsive and unlikable as possible. I mean, he gives them all kinds of traits that you just find repulsive and disgusting. It's basically Frank Herbert is putting a big sign over them saying, don't like these guys. Hate
no,
these guys.
You'd have to be a pretty terrible person to like the Harkonnens. I mean, they literally like incredibly sadistic, torturing people. Yeah. They like hunt their own citizens. They release them into these game preserves and hunt them down and shoot them. And they, you know, have all these gladiatorial kind of games where they, you know, kill people. And they're always like plotting against each other to poison or kill each other.
Even within themselves.
And you know, it's really, and they, so even like when they, you know, somebody does them a great service, they'll turn around and betray him and kill him because they can't let him. So they're as unlikable as any villain ever.
And they're you wonder, well, why does the Emperor support them against the Atreides? And the answer is because the Duke of the Atreides, Duke Leto Atreides, is getting so popular because he's just so good. You know, he's so beloved that the Emperor is a little nervous and jealous of his of him being a threat. And so the Padishah Emperor of the Carinos, he teams up with the Harkonnens to take down this potential rival, you know, and that's why he works with the bad guys against the really good guys. And so I guess basically Duke Leto lives just long enough to kind of make sure Paul is ready to carry forward the family name and honor and traditions and everything and maybe get revenge or whatever. But, let's see, who have we not talked about among the various groups? There's the Spacing Guild. It's, I guess the Dune universe is kind of set up as a multi-leg, like a tripod, but like a multi-leg, structure where there's the great houses like the Atreides, the Harkonnens, the Carinos. There's the Spacing Guild, which everybody needs, the Spacing Guild, the navigators, because you can't get, you know, they're like the only way to go from point A to point B. The distances are so vast.
They have a complete monopoly on it.
Yeah, they have this fleet of gigantic spaceships that don't really travel through space. They just the navigator on board is a really mutated human who uses the power that the spice has given them to fold space so they can just at one minute they're at Arrakis and then poof, you know, they're at Caladan or wherever you want to say. So
sure.
So the Spacing Guild and the Bene Gesserit.
There's the one not so much in the first book, much more later on. There's a group called the Bene Telexiu.
Oh yeah.
Which are like these genetic engineer kind of people, and they create these servants called Face Dancers, who are basically human mimics. They're grown clones, basically, who can assume any appearance of anybody, and
that's pretty so cool. Yeah,
they try to take over at different times, and they're always, and especially in the later books, they're big enemies. And then there's some other enemies groups we can get to as it goes further along, but those are the main ones, I think. And the Freemen, we've talked about them.
Yeah, and then I guess Ix, which is trying to make machines that push the envelope. They get right up to being against the Butlerian Jihad restrictions on thinking machines, and they stop there. Because I like the line where at the very beginning, when the navigator visits the emperor, he says, "We have just folded space from Ix. Many machines on Ix." And I like that it's the ninth planet, so it's Ix, I-X, you know, like Roman numerals. That's kind of cute. They also the genetic manipulators you were talking about with the face dancers, they also make Golas.
Mm-hmm.
Golas are basically clones.
Oh yes, that's right.
There's a little more to them than clones, I guess. They're able eventually to remember. It's sort of like with the Bene Gesserit remembering their past, you know, generations. Mm-hmm. The Golas eventually are learn how to remember their previous life in their original body, which is kind of creepy.
And it is very creepy. And so the main character in that is a guy named Duncan Idaho.
Oh, my gosh. And yes.
The loyal servant and fighter and soldier and companion of House Atreides. And he's killed defending Paul Atreides in the first book. But his cells are collected by the Bene Telexiu. And then a Gola is grown for the Atreides. And then they awaken his memories through a certain process. And then he knows that he is Duncan Idaho. And he knows what he's been through before. Mm-hmm. And so basically, you know, we need to start going into the different books. But he,
yeah.
you know, is brought back countless times, and he's always there. Everybody else, you know, changes and new people come and go, and there's always Duncan Idaho.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the funny thing is, if you only read the first book, Paul Atreides is the main character, and Duncan is a sort of minor side character. If you read all six, Duncan Idaho is the main character.
He
is the main character of the Dune saga. Because, like you say, others come and go. But he is always there. And multiple times. How many times did the God Emperor have him? He like 1,000 of him or something? I mean,
yes.
Oh my
yes.
gosh. And he always ended up doing something crazy, and he'd kill him and then bring another one in or something.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, okay. Well, so I guess the books break down the first Dune book. You can read it entirely on its own if you haven't read them. It stands alone as sort of Star Wars crossed with Lawrence of Arabia, and you know, I guess that's pretty much the big story. But then once Paul succeeds in all of his endeavors there, then you get into more how would you describe the second? I think the second and third books kind of go together. It's really like
it's
one
kind
of
the
story.
Aftermath. So now he's won. They had this big jihad. They took over the universe, and now they had to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's these things you're fighting against when you're the rebel, like, oh, all this bureaucracy and crap, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they take it over and they're like, man, we got to set up some bureaucracy to get stuff done.
Oh, right. Exactly. That's like the Genghis Khan problem I've always said is or the Kang the Conqueror. It's always easier to conquer than it is to, the old saying is that he discovered that the world could not be governed the way that it was conquered on horseback. Mm-hmm. In other words, being a man of action, you conquer the universe, but then you got to make sure the garbage is picked up and the mail is delivered and
trains run on time.
And then it gets really boring. Yeah. And you're like, but it's not that it's boring to Paul. It's that he now has to answer to all those organizations we just talked about. So he now has to answer to the Bene Gesserit, to the navigators, the Spacing Guild, to all the and of course the Harkonnens are still around messing with him.
Well, and he has to answer to this religion that he created.
Yeah,
which basically
his
own religion he created, and it has all this doctrine and stuff. And he's like, well, maybe I don't want to do it that way now. So
right, too bad.
So that is the kind of the aftermath. And I have to say, from a enjoyment as a reader perspective. Mm-hmm. This is how there are like six books, you know, that we're going to talk in this original series. Okay. I love the first book.
Mm-hmm.
I love the first book. I don't love the second and third books. Mm-hmm. I think they're hard to read. I think there's a lot of stuff in there that's kind of dry and not as well done. And a lot of this stuff about prescience and his kids and the, you know, the priesthood and stuff. And it's just, the stories are not as good. And there's a little, it's a little more weird. And then you have the next book is, you know, the fourth book is the God Emperor of Doom. Mm-hmm. And that's the one where his son basically converts himself into a giant immortal sandworm.
We haven't even talked about the sandworms. How do we get this far and not talk about the sandworms?
So one of the primary hazards of living on Dune at the time the Atreides first take over is, you know, the spice is out there. You think, well, why don't they just go get the spice? Well, there's these giant sandworms that are, you know, hundreds of feet long, and there's these huge storms that sweep across the planet, destroying everything. These basically dust sandstorms, mm-hmm. and the sand. If you land on the sand, you basically are collecting the spice. If it, you know, within a few minutes, a sandworm is going to show up, and they're so huge they basically will destroy all your machinery. Mm-hmm. So. And, you know, people are like, oh, we'll just kill them all. But what they figure out is there's this relationship between the sandworms and the spice. It's part of the ecology. You have to have them. So that's what the Freemen know this, but the outside people don't. So mm-hmm. and the Freemen actually, you know, ride on them and use them and stuff. And there's a famous scene at the end of the, and we're spoiling everything here. If you haven't read these books, we should have said this at the beginning, but I apologize. But there's a famous scene at the end of the first book where they blow a hole in this wall of rock and they ride sandworms in and attack the enemy ships with them and stuff. And so, but in the fourth book, Paul's son converts himself into a giant human sandworm crossbreed basically and lives for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And he does this because he's seen the future and he's seen that there's this threat to humanity. And the only way to survive is what he calls the golden path. And that is for him to do this thing and for him to put humanity on this path, a very certain path for thousands of years, and then to basically let go. And that's the only way human beings will survive in the universe. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he does. And it's not something he does because he's a megalomaniac and he wants this power and he wants to rule the universe for thousands of years. He does it because somebody must take on this burden and – it's the only way to keep humans alive. And so he does it as kind of a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And it's hard and lonely for him. And that's why he keeps bringing back Duncan Idaho and stuff. So,
yeah, I was going to say, you know, when you mentioned that, that's a lot of good stuff there. When you mentioned the blasting through the shield wall and they ride the worms in, that's again an example of, you know, there's Herbert, having organic humans and animals, basically they're giant animals, versus machines, you know, versus a mechanical army, basically, and winning. I mean, it, over and over, you see the organic, the human, the physical, defeating the mechanical, defeating the machines. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, it's almost like the Ewoks beating the Stormtroopers in Return of the Jedi.
That's right.
Which Lucas has said was also influenced by Vietnam. You know, you had these jungle mm-hmm. fighters defeating a technological army with helicopters and swift boats and all that. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of, and it was written in 65, you know, the beginning of the Vietnam War. So there's a lot of that kind of, you know, humans with human powers against machines kind of thing going on. And the humans are able to win because they've honed their abilities so much. Yeah, the stuff about, becoming God Emperor. It's unfortunate that, you know, you could see as early as the second or third book where he was going with that. It's like the first book is how Paul conquers the universe. And mm-hmm. then everything else is Paul and his son Leto II dealing with what comes afterward. And like you say, it's especially this looming existential threat. And it never really makes clear what that threat is. As you get into the fifth and sixth books now, you start thinking it's the honored Matras, and it really doesn't turn out to be them, does it? I mean, it's kind of fuzzy in my mind as far as, because see, the answers we ultimately get are through Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson's later books that add on using his notes. But I've talked to Kevin J. Anderson about this a couple of times, and we'll get into that as we move toward the end of it. But I'm not entirely convinced, no matter what they say, that that's exactly where Frank Herbert was going. So talk a little bit about that now, kind of where the ultimate story goes in the later books, I guess.
Okay, so in the God Emperor book, he basically has very tight control over human civilization. And I mean tight control through his army and his religion and everything. He controls everything that happens. And he does this to build in certain things so that when, you know, after thousands of years, he goes away, basically there's a snap and it's called the scattering, and human beings explode out in, you know, as far away from him in the center planets as possible, mm-hmm. and develop all these new abilities and new ways to do things. And so there's this, basically this giant surge in human population and in human potential, because it was like a rubber band that he twisted up over thousands of years and then let it go. And so then they come back from the scattering in the fifth and sixth books. And so those books, to me, after the first book, those two are my favorite.
Yeah.
So they're talking about Chapter House Dune and Heretics of Dune. And they really focus on kind of the people back at the core planets, the Bene Gesserit and some stuff.
They
and
become the main characters in those books.
They become the main characters, and they're dealing with people returning from this. But they have – there are people in there who are descendants of the Atreides and right. the Harkonnens and stuff.
So the Reverend Mothers that we focus on in Heretics and Chapter House are Atreides. They're just Reverend Mothers within the Bene Gesserit.
That's right. And they're fighting against the Bene Telexiu and some of these other people. But then they're also dealing with these people coming back from the scattering. Mm-hmm. And at first they think they're coming back to conquer the original planets and stuff. But then they figure out they're actually running away from something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to find safety and security. And there's all these different groups coming back. The Honored Maters are kind of this mutated evil version of Bene Gesserit who used their power to enslave everybody. And there's all these other.
They don't have the subtlety of the Bene Gesserit. That's the thing that's interesting to me about the Honored Matres is when they come back, they still are women. They're a female order, and they have powers, but they're cruder. You know, they're more barbaric. Like they use sexual enslavement or something, as opposed to more subtle and sophisticated ways of controlling people. And so they're wild in a way, you know, almost. Yes. They don't have that control. And so but there's so many of them and they're so powerful that you get this really interesting chess match where you have a smaller number of more sophisticated women, the Bene Gesserit and the people that work for them, some guys, mm-hmm. and of course, Duncan Idaho always. You have them trying, it's almost like they are on the banks of a creek and the Honored Matres are just this flood rushing down from the mountain, and the Bene Gesserits are trying to slowly control and direct that flood into a positive rather than just blowing everything up. You know, they're having to shape them and change them even as they survive not being killed by them. You know,
because the Bene Gesserit kind of view themselves as the guardians of human development and civilization.
Yeah.
And without them, it would just like everybody's out in the woods beating each other with sticks or whatever. So,
yeah, that's what they think, I think. Yeah.
And that, so they – because they're the ones who have all this human history, and they have all these you know, they've been breeding people for thousands of years, so they have all these records about, you know, all that stuff and all this – all the abilities they have that they're afraid to be lost and all their knowledge. So – that's the later two books, their battles and their struggles to, you know, with these different functions. And
it
ends, like you said, Frank Herbert dies. Yeah. He doesn't finish the series. So if you're one of those people who like has to have an end, you know, and everything tied up with a nice bow, I would say, you know, maybe an issue for you, because he dies and doesn't finish the series, and you don't know what happens. And like you said, his son and Kevin Anderson went on and wrote some other stuff, and they've written a bunch of prequel books, mm-hmm. and then they've written a post book, but it's not the same.
Yeah, the end, and again, I don't want to give it too much spoiler, but at the end of Chapter House, there's a couple of characters that are just total enigmas, and you have no idea who they're supposed to be. They're just kind of weird, and you wonder who they are and what the deal is. And I'm sure there are people listening who have different ideas on this, but of course, Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert try to tell us who they are. So here's how this plays out, not the story, but the events in the real world that kind of shape this, is that supposedly, you know, years later, Brian Herbert found like floppy disks and a box of notes in a safety deposit vault, and also found a bunch of like tractor feed dot matrix printouts in a garage, and put all this together, And that and he didn't know if he could handle it himself, and so he brought in Kevin J. Anderson, who's an extremely prolific and very skillful and talented writer. Mm-hmm. He's written a lot of his own stuff. He's written a lot of Star Wars stuff. He's written, you know, he's done. But he's very, very high output. I've done several conventions with Kevin J. Anderson. I know him. I've talked to him about all this before. The first time I met him, we were talking about this at a panel at Dragon Con, and he was talking about finding all this stuff. And I said, well, as soon as I get back home, I'm going to dig around in my garage and see if I can find any of Frank Herbert's notes. So he wasn't.
Well, but it's very much the. I mean, I'm not saying they're not telling the truth, okay?
Right.
But it is very much the cynical, we have this huge unfinished saga of best-selling books. The author died. What if he left us his notes and we could write the book he intended to write and make millions of dollars off it?
And instead of – this is what's interesting. Instead of just writing the final book, instead they wrote several prequels just exploring the families.
Many.
Yeah. Then they wrote a whole series explaining the Butlerian Jihad. Now, to be fair, I understand in retrospect why they did that, because their answer, and we are told the, you know, Frank Herbert's answer, but all we have to go by is what they wrote, Kevin J. Anderson and Brian Herbert wrote. We are told their answer tied directly, that Frank Herbert's answer tied directly back to the Butlerian Jihad. And so basically they felt like they had to explain the Butlerian Jihad more clearly and lay it all out so that then they could do the sequel to Chapter House, which they ended up doing two more books. I believe Hunters of Dune and Sandworms of Dune are the final two,
yes,
which answer all the questions and resolve the big finale. But a lot of people were not thrilled with the answers that they presented. And I would argue this. I have no reason to doubt that that's true, that the answers that they give in those two books are, in fact, where Frank Herbert was going. But the quote-unquote problem is that the way they tell it is like just a sort of contemporary action-adventure science fiction story. Mm-hmm. And that just does not fit with the way Frank Herbert wrote it. You know, it's like, I'm trying to think, I mean, of something to compare it to. It's like going from trying to explain World War II to Grenada. You know, it's like you're going from this.
Well, here's the difference. It's like it's trying to explain World War II to playing like a Call of Duty version of World War II.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the analogy to me. It's like there's all this depth and complexity and all these other levels of the thing, and then there's kind of the shoot 'em up side.
Yeah, it turns into kind of a shoot 'em up. I mean, there's more to it than that exactly, but it's so much. And again, I don't mean it in any way as an insult on Anderson and Frank and Brian Herbert. I mean, as far as just a contemporary science fiction action adventure novel, they're very good. Mm-hmm. They're just not Dune the way that Frank Herbert wrote it. And I think it'd be unfair to expect anybody to be able to do that.
That's right.
So you get an answer if you're planning on reading the series. You do ultimately get an answer. It just may not be quite what you had built yourself up to. It's almost like if Return of the Jedi, well, I started to say had been done with Muppets, but it was. It was done with Muppets, so never mind.
Oh my gosh.
Undercut my argument there, didn't I? So,
Well, all right, so we talked about the books a lot. What do you think about these TV series? And we got to talk about the movie.
And the movie. All right, well, let me give you my overview of the three things, all right, first, and then we can talk in more detail. And I want to hear what you think, too. The first, in 1984, there had been several attempts, including the famous Jaworski, I can't ever say it right, that version that was supposed to come along in the mid-70s, mm-hmm. That H.R. Giger had done a bunch of the pre-production art for before he went on to do Alien.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be humongous, but he ended up not doing it. And there is a movie now called Jaworski's Dune, which is just about them trying to make Dune as a movie in the 1970s. I still haven't seen it, but I'm dying to see it. So there's that. Okay. Then after Star Wars and everything that happened in the late 70s, it got a renewed push. And in 1984, David Lynch directed a version of Dune with Kyle MacLachlan, a young Kyle MacLachlan as Paul, and it was like a Dino De Laurentiis movie, though, and which always means it's going to be a big, giant production, and it's going to suck. Just like all of his big productions are, you know. And so they poured tons of money into it. David Lynch is definitely a director who has a point of view. He has a style, kind of like Tim Burton has a style, and you always know it's a Tim Burton movie. You can always tell a David Lynch movie. They're weird. They're kind of off center. And so you got this giant production of Dune with tons of money poured into it, directed by a real visionary director, and it looks gorgeous. I think that Dune, this 84 movie, looks beautiful. It looks exactly like I imagined it, but the script was not good. It's just so hard to whittle all that down to like 2 hours. So what did you think about the Lynch movie?
Here's what I'm going to say about the Lynch movie. My high school friends and I saw that in the theater, like at the midnight show, I think the day it came out.
Yeah.
And I walked out of the theater, I pushed the doors open, walked out of the lobby, and I basically yelled, "Oh my gosh, that sucked."
You just wept. Huh?
I love
Dune.
Damn
you, David Lynch.
I love Dune so much. And it had, like you said, it was there. It had so much potential. The costumes and the artwork and stuff was really good. But the script was so bad.
Yeah.
And it was so painful. It made me mad.
I went with my high school girlfriend, and, you know, she had basically been promised Star Wars again, you know. And she's just sitting there the whole time looking at me like, "What is this?" And I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So
the one thing I remember is that one of the key elements of the book is that the Emperor's rivalry with the Atreides is because the Atreides are getting very popular with the other nobles, and they're developing their military force to almost as good as the Emperor's elite legions of stormtroopers, the Sarkar. Yeah. Okay.
Love the Sarkar.
And so that was one of the main points. Instead, they make up this whole thing about how they developed this sound wave weapon.
The weirding module. Oh, my.
Which was just a bunch of words thrown together and a bunch of BS they added, which just, and again, is technology, which is not what they were supposed to do.
Right.
And that's the thing, the reason that caused the Emperor to attack them. And it's just like, that's so stupid.
Yeah, it goes against everything in the whole basic idea of the story.
And that's... And, you know, of course, you had Sting as Fade Rotha, which was entertaining, but so disappointing. So anyhow, then we had the sci-fi TV series.
Yeah, they come back around in I guess about the late, maybe like 98, 99, somewhere in there. They did Frank Herbert's Dune, which was like a 3-part miniseries on Sci-Fi Channel. And it's the exact opposite in every way of the Lynch movie.
They know precisely where we are and what we can do.
Who damns my mother for bearing daughters instead of sons?
We shall see what devices this perverse mind is breeding.
You're Duke's son. You have duties, responsibilities.
How could I ever forget?
Put some spice in each one and send them to the Baron on Giddy Prime.
I'm the instrument of his family's demise.
Such a beautiful boy.
It's got a pretty solid script. but it looks like a stage play. And in fact, that's what I think of when I watch the first Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, Frank Herbert's Dune, is that the costumes are so fake and the sets are so cheap, it looks like a stage play production. But the script is actually pretty good, and so I'm kind of willing to overlook that.
That's right.
It's just now, it's like a polar opposite of the movie.
The script is 100% on. Mm-hmm. It's exactly right. But the other parts, like you said, it really does look like some high school kid shot it.
Yeah.
Because of the budget. But I appreciate them being pure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So they give us something worth watching, but if you can just get past the costumes in particular are just so bad, and they all look like they just got sewn together 5 minutes ago. Nothing well, is worn, nothing is, you know, everything is bright colors and angles, and it looks like the same costume designer designed everybody's costume.
Well, because I'm sure they did.
Well, exactly.
They can't do the big CG. There's no CGI,
yeah.
You know, obviously, because for the time frame and the budget. So there's no giant sandworm CGI or spaceship CGI or any of the other stuff. So.
And then they come back in 2003, I believe, with Children of Dune, which was an amalgamation of Dune Messiah and Children of Dune, which makes sense because it really is one big story. And they make kind of a 6-hour miniseries again out of that. And I thought that was the one they finally got it all right. I mean,
yeah.
I don't – the one problem I have with both of the Sci-Fi Channel's productions, both of those, is the stunt casting. They go and get one kind of big actor to be in it who kind of takes you out of the story because all the other actors in these things – are either people you've never seen before or they're sort of European, Eastern European or something. They get these wonderful Eastern, like Romanian and Czech actors that you've never seen before that are great. And then there's William Hurt. And I'm like, he's just so not Emperor, Duke Leto. And in the second one, you have all those great actors again. And they bring back the best actors from the first version. You even have... As Paul's son, you have what's his name that's playing young Charles Xavier in the X-Men movies now.
Yes,
McAvoy.
Mm-hmm.
You have McAvoy's great as Leto. You have just a wonderful cast, and then you have the leader of the Carinos, the daughter of the Padishah Emperor who has been overthrown, played by Susan Sarandon. And I'm supposed to be in mortal terror of the scary, scary Susan Sarandon as Winsicchia, yeah. the Carino heir. I mean, what was funny was that they had the lady that played the Borg Queen and can be legitimately scary. Mm-hmm. They have her playing Jessica, the nice mom.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like very strange casting. In fact, I almost wonder if they didn't offer Susan Sarandon the part of Lady Jessica and what's her name that plays the Borg Queen the other part, and they swapped.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes so much more sense the other way around. Susan Sarandon is the nice mom.
It was her. Sorry.
Yeah. Oh Lord, yeah. But I mean everybody else, the actress that plays the grown up Alia is awesome. Mm-hmm. The actress that plays Princess Irulan is awesome.
I don't have any complaints about the acting.
Yeah. So, and the costumes were a lot better in Children of Dune, I thought. You could tell they fired somebody. Somebody got fired.
Where they got an extra couple $1,000 to spend on that.
Yeah.
But the other part is, again, I don't think and they were very pure in the story, and I appreciate that, but the story itself is not as good, I think. That's my
right. Opinion. Yeah, it's kind of tough because the first one has such a good story, but it's just done – and it's the script is good, but it's done so cheap. And the second one has a much weaker story unless you're just really into – you know. And I love it, but I mean, you know, yeah. If you're really into the whole church versus state political argument, all that, I mean – And a lot of sort of metaphysical stuff where, like I said, Alia is being taken over by these voices in her head and everything. I mean, but it really is the best of them in terms of how it's put together. So I give a thumbs up to both of the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries. As long as you go in understanding, there's going to be several things that really jump out at you, like William Hurt and Susan Sarandon and the horrible costumes in the first one. So
that's right.
All right. Any other thoughts about the live action production. I'm surprised there's never been like an animated one or something.
No, I know they were the highest rated shows ever on Sci-Fi, I think, at the time, you know, until recently. So,
yeah, well, I mean, and there's been some talk of doing a third version at some point, but it's just so hard because it's hard to do. It is hard to do a Dune that is both interesting for the non-intellectual sci-fi readers, but also true to the books.
To me, you couldn't do all of them, but you could do the first book as kind of an HBO Game of Thrones thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of like it's kind of like Lord of the Rings. I mean, you had to bring in a Peter Jackson that could go back and forth between being very true to Tolkien on the one hand and then giving you Legolas surfing down a stairway, killing people. You know, you have to be able to do both with equal facility to really, because you're going to need, you know, part of the audience is going to want sci-fi action adventure and part of the audience is going to say, this isn't like Frank Herbert.
That's right.
And you have to balance those two things. And that's incredibly difficult. It has to be incredibly difficult to do that. So, yeah, so it's a very challenging thing, and I mean, honestly, I'd almost rather see television and movies stick to original stories where they can shape it to that kind of a medium, rather than trying to take something that works so well in one and almost, you know, ruining it by transposing it over. I mean, because there's so many, you know, like for example, the modern Battlestar Galactica touches on a lot of similar themes in a lot of ways, but was made to be a TV series on Sci-Fi within their budget constraints and all that, and as a weekly show, and I think it works a lot better. So, yes. You know, different stories work better in different media. You know?
That's fair. So
what about the impact of Dune overall on science fiction and culture and all that?
I think the culture side is interesting because I think it's almost none in a lot of ways. There's not, you know, these conventions. There's not, you know, these huge Dune has not permeated, you know, popular culture in the way that Star Wars or Star Trek or even Battlestar Galactica has.
That's right.
You don't see people talking about or referring to the terms or the things about Dune like the way they did these other things. And so I think that's the one part of it. And it probably because it's, you know, they're not easy to get into and there hasn't been a high quality, easy movie or TV version. That's probably a lot of it. But I think, you know, in terms of its permeating science fiction, I think a lot of the ideas that he came up with, you see them in these other places.
Right, right.
And I think it really was Granby. The other thing is, you know, it's such a great book. The story is he could not get the book published. He went to 20 publishers and could not get it published. And you know who the original publisher was?
No.
Chilton's. The publishing company that did those car manuals in the 1960s, 70s,
Oh, wow. I didn't realize
80s.
That. That's amazing.
That was the only company that would publish the original book. I'm sure, you know, people younger than us have no idea what that is. But,
yeah.
You know, that and back before the internet, if you needed to know something about how to fix something on your car, you could buy a manual for your specific model and tell you everything, basically. So,
yeah, that's interesting because I think it's been with Berkeley as long as I can remember. But, yeah, so it is fascinating. It's because it's probably the most influential work, arguably the most influential work in science fiction, certainly in the second half of the 20th century. And yet beyond that world, it has had very, very limited impact. I think, you know, in some ways it kind of shares the same issue that John Carter of Mars did, which is by the time it came to the public, its pieces had already been broken off and used everywhere else. You know, when John Carter came out, people were like, oh, I've seen this a million times before. This is a total ripoff. And, you know, people are like me are going, this was the original.
Yeah, this is the source material. Yeah. All the things ripped this off.
Yeah, you know, people see Dune now like, oh, this is a ripoff of Star Wars. And I start pulling my hair out because that's like the same people that said that Gandalf was a total ripoff of Dumbledore from Harry Potter, you know. And I just start pulling my hair out again. So, but yeah, it has been so, so influential on science fiction and is considered probably I think it's the best selling science fiction novel, the original book is, of all time. And as funny as I don't think it even got, I think it had to split the Hugo Award of 1965 with another book, which may in fact have been a Roger Zelazny book, which is kind of cool to me because he's my favorite writer. But I mean, it's funny how, you know, over time these things are seen differently. And I think it really is considered the masterpiece of modern science fiction. So
absolutely. And I really, really highly recommend that. Again, if you just want to read the first book and stop, that is absolutely a legitimate way to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like watching Star Wars and then not, you know, you don't have to go on and find out all the stuff about Anakin and all that.
Or Jar Jar or whatever.
But, right. Exactly.
Which I would say is the his son wrote. But And if you read the series and you get into the second or third or fourth book, and again, even the fourth book where he's the God Emperor, that's thousands of years where sometimes not a lot happens. Even those books are not super fun, enjoyable to read, but the fifth and sixth books get back to basically it's wide open, level playing field, you don't know who's going to win, and it's really well done.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, I think if you start feeling like you're bogged down in all the metaphysical and philosophical stuff, just you know, bear down and keep going, because it does a lot of it make more sense in retrospect, you know, as you go further. And you are in able hands, so you're never going to be lost. You're never going to be, he's never taking you down a rabbit hole. You know, it's always
That's
going,
right.
it's always going somewhere.
Yeah.
And even if you're a little confused, just stick with it and you'll come back out. So, all right. Well, any last thoughts about Dune? I think we've done a pretty comprehensive overview. Yeah. I'm sure we've left something glaring out that we'll realize tomorrow. But
well, and people could certainly email us or tweet us, whatever, and let us know what they think about this podcast and our coverage of the topic. But it's a series I've always enjoyed, and I've treasured it, and I still do. So.
And I think that like if you like stuff like the modern Warhammer 40,000 and the Horus Heresy and all that, there is no doubt in my mind that they basically just took kind of a Dune universe and have more shooting and killing. You know, it's like a pulpy action version of Dune is the whole Warhammer stuff. It's that, you know, giant universe that's has been conquered and all that. So, all right. Well, I guess the Rocket will get on out of here for another week. Be sure to check out go to www.whiterocketbooks.com to see, you know, in fact, I have a series of my own that's kind of heavily influenced by this. In fact, my Legion One Lords of Fire novel was called by Pulp Fiction Reviews Dune as written by Robert E. Howard, which I thought was a
nice,
pretty cool review. Yeah. There's lots of cool stuff there. And you can also find previous episodes of this show at whiterocket.podbean.com. And otherwise, I guess we will get out of here for another week. So, John, thank you for coming on. And the Rocket will get on out of here, and we will see you all down the road. See you, John.
Thanks for having me, man.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.